Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
3 summers ago, Portlanders stood united in demanding changes to the institution of policing and the Portland Police Bureau. Since then, the Police Accountability Commission has been building a proposal for a new voter-mandated, civilian-led police oversight system. For the July edition of Totality of Circumstances, members of the PAC will be live in the KBOO studio to field your questions and comments before their final plan goes to the City Council at the end of August. Tune in and give us a call on Tuesday, July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m. or send us an email at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com or join us live on Tuesday, July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. I'm Norm Diamond, your host this morning. Patricia Kohlberg is with me as our producer. Today is July 24th. That's the day that Henry David Thoreau went to jail in 1846 for refusal to pay his taxes. Thoreau argued that paying taxes would make him complicit with a government staging an unjust war against Mexico. Paying taxes further would mean supporting a government that supported the continued existence of slavery. 177 years later, Thoreau's act of civil disobedience gives us two big themes for today's program: Mexico and what's happening to Mexican society, and the ongoing consequences of slavery in the United States. Before getting there, and to our book review about a right-wing demagogue here in Oregon, and also a segment honoring the memory of a great Marxist scholar here in the Pacific Northwest, I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means the station is able to broadcast precisely because it's funded by you, the listener. If you're able, please support the station by making a contribution today, or even better, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Let's begin with racism. What do you think is the best way to overcome it? Act in a race-neutral manner, as if racism doesn't exist, or actively try to redress it? I'd personally add a third possibility, the need to get rid of an economic system that requires antagonisms and discriminations in the population. But we'll get to that later in the program. On June 29th, the Supreme Court ruled that race could no longer be an explicit factor in college and university admissions, that the redress provided by affirmative action is no longer legal. In their Left in the Law segment, John Hawken and Mike Snedeker discussed the significance and scope of this decision, the history of Supreme Court decisions around race and education, and the potential for resistance to this and other recent Supreme Court rulings. Jan?
Ending all forms of affirmative action in schools and hiring decisions is a long-standing goal and promise of right-wing politicians. The reactionary wing of the Supreme Court delivered on that promise last month in ruling that admission policies at Harvard and the University of North Carolina that included race as a factor were unconstitutional and therefore not lawful under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The decision makes using race as a factor in college admissions illegal. Well, Mike, in the commentary since the ruling, there are a range of assessments on its significance and its scope. What's your assessment?
Well, it's a continuation of the Supreme Court's essential racism and willful blindness to the fact that this country was constructed on the basis of slavery, and that our efforts to end the impact of slavery have sputtered and frequently have been brought to a halt by Supreme Court decisions. You know, with a conspicuous exception of the 50s and 60s during the Warren Court and the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the High Court has been consistently against anything and everything that would modify the profound impact of slavery. It has done its best to gut the Equal Protection Amendment and did so right after the Civil War in a series of cases called the Slaughterhouse Cases and the Civil Rights Cases. It did so in Plessy v. Ferguson, which essentially created Jim Crow by legitimizing segregation, by allowing first schools and then swimming pools and virtually every part of life to be completely segregated, and gave a huge boost to the rebirth of the South and the lost cause ideology that led to the construction of all those statues of Confederate generals and monuments to the South that popped up all over that region during the first part of the 20th century. Finally, in the Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, very unlike the one we're talking about today, held that separate but equal is a myth, that it's not at all a reality. But even if it were a reality, it would still be a permanent stigma, and decisively rejected the whole idea of segregated education and therefore segregated life as a lawful construction.
Now, in some of the citing of Brown versus the Board of Education, justices seem to acknowledge this history, but as Sandra Day O'Connor decided almost 25 years ago, affirmative action is important as a historical effect, lingering effect of slavery and Jim Crow laws, but that it's long past as an issue. So the judges seem to argue that yes, there is this history, but it's kind of a PTSD syndrome for Black people. They have to get over it, the lingering anxiety that's no longer anchored in reality. In fact, there are people, clinicians, who talk about PTSD among Black people as an effect of slavery, which implies that it's a kind of collective neurosis you have to shake off. What's your take on that argument, which doesn't deny that history you cite, but argues that we have to put it behind us?
Well, that's not at all what they decided. They decided that it was a completely ahistorical decision. They said that the best way to get rid of racism is to get rid of racism. And the best way to end racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. So they simply do not acknowledge and make only the most fleeting reference to the fact that there has been a long history in this country of racism, beginning with treating Black people as commodities to be bought and sold and tortured and raped at will. Any effort whatsoever to make reparations, and that's what affirmative action basically is slapped down by this court. The fear that they have that emanates from their decision comes from the fact that they're closing their eyes completely to this long history. Justice Roberts is very clear on that he's assuming that we're beginning from day one today and saying henceforth there cannot be any consideration of race, thus ignoring the past several centuries and the fact that race, contrary to what he says, does matter.
Yeah, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson made this point in her dissent and described it as a let them eat cake obliviousness to the role of race in daily life. you're saying that also this concern about the partisan nature of the Supreme Court has a long history and is on mighty display today, but has this long history to it. What's your take on that argument that the Supreme Court has become now so partisan that risks its losing its legitimacy?
Well, that's the best part of this case, is that the Supreme Court has undermined itself in so many ways with making decisions like the Dobbs decision that are really deeply against what most Americans feel. Also with their endemic corruption and the fact that it's clear that nobody can really do anything about it. They can accept millions of dollars worth of luxurious benefits from people who have direct interest in cases that they decide, and no one can call them up on it. One striking thing about this opinion are the dissents. It's not at all like Brown, which was all unanimous, nine people all on the speaking in one voice. Here we've got concurrences ranging from grumpy to self-justifying, and we've got dissents that are extraordinarily strong and well-written, one by Justice Sotomayor that really takes apart the legal reasoning and Justice Roberts' effort to discuss and rely on and distinguish earlier cases like the Bakke case or the Grutter case that have addressed this issue in the past. And Ketanji Brown Jackson does a stunning job of summarizing real life of racism, the fact that not only were Black people tortured and commoditized during slavery, but after Jim Crow, up until very recently, they were not allowed to get home loans. The FHA, created in 1934, explicitly refused to extend loans to Black people. So the main generator of wealth in this country, the ownership of a house, was flat denied to Black people until not long ago. So she takes two applicants to the University of North Carolina, both of them smart, capable, love their state, want to advance. One of them with seven generations of prosperous activity in the community, the other with one, because his ancestors were commodities, and then she runs through all the restrictions that have weighed Black people down in North Carolina since they first came to North Carolina.
And including schools and different experiences through schooling that prepare them for college.
So she's looking at real life and where race does matter, particularly in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. I think everybody, regardless of your reaction to that, would recognize that race does matter. People can say that they can cast all kinds of aspersions on the people demonstrating against the police. They can support all those demonstrations saying they're far overdue, but nobody in their right mind would say that race does not matter.
You know, Mike, one line of commentary, including among progressives and areas of the left, has focused on the winnowing down of affirmative action rulings and moving away from anything that has to do with reparations to Black people themselves or people of color, and instead arguing legally that the interests of universities is in the diversity of their communities. And so it becomes a add people of color and mix, you know, that you need this diversity for a vibrant campus. And even on those grounds, of course, that there are ways of arguing for affirmative actions. Actually, in recent years, with the economic problems and the pandemic and other factors accumulating in a way that makes minority representation in many campuses less than it was 5 years ago, it's still harder to argue on those grounds. Would you give any weight to that affirmative action has been has lost a lot of its progressive edge as it's moved toward this more ambiguous area of creating a diverse university community rather than anything related to reparations.
Well, I don't see them as contradictory at all. I think that was a big argument of North Carolina, that we have a better campus, that people learn more in law school classes, they learn more in any sociological class, they learn more in any class, even hard sciences, by experiencing diversity, and that discussions are livelier, more to the point, people advance. There are ways of quantifying that were made part of the record before the Supreme Court. So I think the obligations that we have to make reparations are not at all limited by the fact that, in truth, the diversity has real-world advantages of all sorts, emotional, quantitative, qualitative, of expanding people's understanding of the world in which they live. It's a good thing, and that North Carolina demonstrated that with all sorts of studies and anecdotes, but the Supreme Court waved them off as saying, the colleges say, quote, trust us, close quotes, but they said, we cannot do that given the equal protections requirement of strict scrutiny and the fact that you haven't told us exactly how long it's going to last and what it's, the two or three beefs they have with the fact that it's not going to be something that has a discern as an ending in sight. I mean, Jackson says that the end will come when we have created a truly colorblind society, that people have access to opportunity, everyone has access to opportunities. That's when it will end. But that's, as you said, Sandra Day O'Connor said, well, let's do this. I think 25 years ought to be enough. That'll clean everything up for the past few centuries.
Well, let's talk about the next 25 years that we've got ahead of us now and how we might navigate this terrain. You know, the white supremacists in the South refused to comply. They were forced to, some with government marshals at the doors of their schools, but they continued to fight even with the dismantling of segregation, and they're still waving their flags today. So in terms of the potential for resistance to this decision, I think it's interesting to look at Justice Amy Coney Barrett herself and her worries about reactions to Supreme Court decisions that are out of step with how many, if not most, Americans think. She said on a recent speaking tour that, and this is paraphrasing a long speech, that she was there to convince people that the court was not just a group of partisan hacks, because if that's how the court is viewed, then their authority is going to be limited and checked by people, by democratic institutions who say, why are you the ones that get to decide whether, for example, we can regulate very dangerous firearms, whether we can address climate change, and whether we can respond to the host of all the other current day problems that you know we are struggling with? So, Mike, is there some grounds for her worry? Why this group of people that can decide the fate of so many, if not most, people living in this country?
Well, she's exactly right. That's the best thing that can come out of this decision, is the fact that the Supreme Court made it. That court is held in such low regard across the board in this country. It's going to create a pall over the legitimacy of this affirmative action decision. And as you wrote, that is, in many ways, most people don't like affirmative action because they don't really, it has not been understood clearly, and it's people who are advocating it feel somehow guilty about it. The fact that the Supreme Court, and it has no army of its own, she's right, it requires respect for its decisions to count. I'm grateful that they are held under such low regard, because that makes, paradoxically, different sorts of affirmative action really possible, really saleable on a large scale. It really becomes easier to explain why it's beneficial for everyone, and as well as being a moral obligation.
And does this have the potential for widening discussion, educating about both the limits of affirmative action at elite schools that most people of color and working class white people are not able to attend because they're financially prohibitive? So there's that narrow path that is offered to the what used to be called the talented 10%. But I think widening public discussion about the purpose of education and who is admitted to these prestigious schools and all of the hierarchies that are formed around them and their prestige, as well as alliances between working class people of color and white people who are not able to buy houses anymore, not able to get an education, who cannot, you know, borrow $50,000 a year to put your kids through school. What do you see in the prospects on that front of broadening the movement for truly public education?
Well, I've been really heartened by the fact that now people are actually talking about all over the place the notion of legacy admissions. The truth is that Harvard is, people think it's all for smart people, but it's really all for well-connected people. It's part of the creation of an aristocracy in the United States. 43% of the white people attending Harvard now are there as a, quote, legacy. That means it's a hand-down, something you inherit, that you, namely the right to enter Harvard. You know, Jared Kushner was admitted to Harvard the year after his father gave Harvard $2.5 million. If you have parents who can give a school $2 million, you're going to get in. that's the way it works.
And LP, you don't see the spotlight on these people very often. And when they question themselves, do I really belong here? Or was I just admitted because of connections? Which is what people of color are, you know, have to deal with, that cloud of doubt around whether they really belong there. Apparently, Clarence Thomas has never gotten over his own anxiety about that. So there is also this discussion on a more practical level of abandoning many of the traditional measures, SAT scores and other measures where you have cutoff points that are adjusted for groups under affirmative action, instead relying on letters of recommendation from teachers or essays where the life experience of students is given more emphasis. Those are also very time-consuming ways of evaluating applicants, and also have benefited from where students who've had the resources to get coaching on those materials. So that does not deliver us from the history of these same dynamics, but it seems to acknowledge in a way the subjectivity and sort of the arbitrariness of some of these factors that separate people into meritorious and less meritorious piles.
Well, that's true. And this decision will trigger all kinds of creative ways of surmounting itself. I mean, there are avenues left open by the majority that allow you, for example, to talk individually about the impact of race in your own life. There are things that can be done and should be done, and it will be done to counter this. But it will have, it's its broad effect beyond just people trying to squeeze into high prestige universities, just as Brown v. Board of Education or Plessy v. Ferguson, the initial case that legitimized segregation, each reverberated far beyond the particular topic they were dealing with, because they set forth a principle about race. You know, are we going to consider race? Can races be treated distinctly? Must they be, you know, these principles that will be derived from this are what we need to be afraid of and to combat. And which we need to be grateful that this court is relatively down now in terms of the prestige with which its holdings are held. One reason why the court is so powerful now, and it is, despite the fact that many people, a growing number of people, have a great disdain for the court, is the fact that the legislature has effectively withdrawn. One, it's kind of cowardly, turning things over to the executive or to the judicial branches of government. And the other is it's perfectly split. It's due to the host of different reasons having to do with how legislative areas are drawn, gerrymandering, et cetera. But it's really difficult to undo the court itself. To even limit the court's jurisdiction was perfectly within Congress's power to do. They can strike down the right or the ability of the Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of different kinds of legislation. They can, of course, expand the court. They can do various things. But what they really need to do is just get active, do things. Now, they don't do anything, and therefore there's a void of power that the executive branch and the judicial branch have been filling up.
There is always room for resistance if we know how to organize and educate. So we'll have to track that, see where the next 25 years takes us.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike. Stay cool, and we'll continue to follow this.
All right.
Thank you, Old Moles, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker. Are Left and the Law Partnership. One of their regular emphases is on the importance of history, specifically on how conflicting interpretations of history shape legal decisions, which of course then have their own ongoing impact. Prior Supreme Court decisions based on white supremacist myths about slavery and its aftermath, in turn, reinforced those myths and were a big part of enabling slavery-like practices to continue. We've done past segments on the Ku Klux Klan, both nationally and in Oregon. Today, Old Mole Matt Witt reviews a recent book by historian Jeffrey Lalande on right-wing demagoguery in Southern Oregon, including a familiar-sounding effort to overturn election results. Could Donald Trump have had this precedent in mind? The book is The Jackson County Rebellion. Here's Matt Witt.
Sometime around the Great Recession of 2008, I got to talking with a clerk at my local post office about one thing and another, and she casually mentioned that her father used to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. This was not in the southern United States, but in southern Oregon, in the small town where I live in Jackson County. And it's not ancient history. As organizing by the Klan and other similar groups increased in our county after the election of Donald Trump to the White House. So I was particularly interested in a new book by historian Jeffrey Lalande called The Jackson County Rebellion. It's about the history of KKK organizing in Southern Oregon and about the economic and social conditions that helped a violent, racist, anti-Semitic movement thrive here in the 1930s. The book reminded me of two important lessons. One is that right-wing demagogues gain traction when there are underlying economic insecurities and cultural resentments that they can exploit. The second is that the right-wing movements we face today are not a new phenomenon, but draw on a long-standing tradition in our state and in our nation. As Lalande's book explains, the Klan's heyday in Southern Oregon was in the 1920s, when hooded Klansmen openly marched in Ashland's July 4th parade, and candidates for office eagerly sought the Klan's endorsement. The book describes how a Klan night riders kidnapped a black man, put a rope around his neck, threatened to lynch him, and then fired bullets at his feet as he fled across the county line. But the Klan's appeal was not just based on racism and anti-Semitism. As cities like Medford grew in size, an economic and cultural divide developed. On one side of that divide were Chamber of Commerce business types and college-educated professionals, and on the other side were more isolated rural residents who lived on farming and logging. They fought over water rights and over whether the sheriff should interfere with moonshiners who depended on income from liquor production, even though it was illegal. And rural residents increasingly resented the share of the wealth they produced that was taken by merchants and middlemen and the railroads. As the Great Depression began in the early 1930s, rural residents and small business people had additional complaints. Big companies began laying off longtime loyal workers. Merchants like Harry and David lent money to farmers with small orchards and then took their land through foreclosure when they couldn't pay. The federal government insisted that growers stop using an insecticide made of arsenic and lead, a necessary public health change that many growers adapted to, but others fought. When rural residents raised their grievances, they were often looked down upon by the business establishment and the local media as uneducated hillbillies. According to Leland's account, the powers that be had over the years successfully kept out progressive organizers from groups like the Industrial Workers of the World. So the stage was set for the emergence of a demagogue from the right. His name was Llewellyn Banks, and while he was a rich landowner himself and owner of his own newspaper, he put himself forward as spokesman for those who were being taken advantage of by the local elites. Banks was a blowhard prone to exaggeration and slurs against opponents, but his bluster only endeared him more to his followers. He attracted many residents who had been involved in the Klan, as he and his allies attacked Jews and America's foreign population. Banks railed against farm cooperatives that were being formed to boost rural income, saying they were manifestations of world communism. And he advocated for a retired general as a candidate in the 1932 presidential election, saying the country needed a dictator who would enforce law and order. When a paramilitary group emerged back east, like the brown shirts who supported Hitler in Germany, Banks said it was a sign that young America has not lost its manhood and its honor. When Banks and his allies appeared to have lost a local election, they dispatched some young men who broke into the courthouse, stole bags of ballots, burned some, and dropped the rest in the Rogue River. And that became Banks's undoing. As low-level participants in the attempt to steal the election began to confess, two police officers went to Banks's house to arrest him for his role in the scheme. Banks shot and killed one of the officers and ultimately was convicted of the crime. As a resident of Southern Oregon today, some of this obviously sounds familiar. As in most of the country, economic inequality has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Most residents are working harder with a lot less to show for it, while a few real estate interests and other wealthy speculators get richer. Climate change disproportionately affects those who can least afford it, and corporate lobbyists are systematically dismantling the social safety net. The business establishment in the Rogue Valley today has mostly kept out unions and other organizations that could be pushing for progressive solutions. And some of the professional and business class continue to look down on what they call rednecks, who supposedly are unhappy only because they are ignorant. In the meantime, the election of Donald Trump in 2016 led to a surge in threats and harassment against Black, Latinx, and LGBTQ people in the region. An office shared by Rogue Valley community organizers was defaced with white supremacist material in the middle of the night, and an armed man threatened them because they supposedly were promoting white genocide. The Klan itself reemerged recently with active recruiting in Medford. And shortly after, a gunman entered a temple in Pittsburgh and killed 11 Jews, a Jewish congregation in Ashland needed an armed guard to keep two self-described Holocaust deniers from entering their place of worship. Afterward, one of those two men posted on Facebook that Jews dominate the American political landscape, and as a result, is there any wonder why America, as exemplified by its youth, is slipping into a cesspool of obesity, addiction, idiocy, moral impoverishment, and general malaise? The other told followers that the Ku Klux Klan was originally created to protect Southerners from powerful Jews who had Lincoln killed and roaming gangs of recently freed slaves inflicting murder, rape, and vandalism on whites. After Trump's election prompted an increase in hate crime activity in Jackson County, residents of Talent, the town where I live, brought a resolution to the city council that said that the city of Talent will do everything in its power to protect the places of worship, homes, businesses, schools, and community centers of those who are Muslim, immigrants, or people of color. Although more than 300 people showed up at a council meeting to support the resolution, the three Republicans on the council at that time voted no, and it passed only because the mayor broke a 3-3 tie. Jeffrey Leland's book, The Jackson County Rebellion, is a timely reminder that what has happened throughout our history can happen again, anytime, anywhere. And our communities will continue to be threatened as long as we don't address the underlying economic and social inequality that provides fertile ground for demagogues and purveyors of hate.
Thank you, Matt Witt. To start the program, I mentioned Henry David Thoreau's protest on this day, 177 years ago, against the U.S. government's support both for slavery and for military aggression against Mexico. In part one of her interview with Mexican journalist José Luis Granado Ceja, Old Mo Luisa Martinez focused on media distortions about AMLO, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and the history of U.S.-Mexican relations. In part two, she pursues these themes, looking at the weaponization of academia on behalf of imperialism and the political party that AMLO heads. There's an election coming up in the U.S. and in Mexico. What might the future hold? Here is the second part of Luisa Martinez's interview with José Luis Granado Ceja.
And I know you. I said earlier in your introduction that you're pursuing a master's degree in human rights. And I was curious, could you please give your perspective? Like, what role does academia play, particularly in the West, in terms of entrenching these narratives about AMLO being undemocratic, about Mexico?
You know, we've seen the resurgence of these think tanks. They serve an ideological agenda. They are meant to advance ideas. It's a way of almost, the word I would use is launder ideas. So there's these elite ruling class interests, and they want to see certain policies, you know, put forward. And so they filter them through these think tanks that they fund. You know, I think about the Brookings Institution, the Wilson Center. They've all been very, very critical of Mexico, López Obrador. They're the ones who are feeding this narrative that it's, you know, regression into authoritarianism. It's the same language that they use against other left projects throughout Latin America, you know. And it's successful, right? That a lot of projects that have sought, you know, to construct socialism of the 21st century have been demonized. And it's very difficult to advance a defense of these projects in that context. Specifically around academia, you know, I made the decision to enter this human rights program because I was tired of seeing the weaponization of human rights in service of imperialism. You know, oftentimes we only see conversations about civil, political rights, and they're important to defend, right? But we have to understand that they exist in a dialectical, complementary relationship with the positive rights, the economic, social, and cultural rights. You know, for example, here in Mexico, when we talk about human rights, yes, of course, we talk about freedom of expression, freedom of association, the right to vote, the respecting, you know, the civil and political rights. But we also talk about the right to housing, the right to a dignified job, the right to access culture, the right to, you know, unionization, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of a more fuller in spectrum of the human rights. And so when we only focus on one side, on the negative rights and to the detriment of the positive rights, we actually aren't guaranteeing human rights. But that's the only conversation you hear, is that you know, this authoritarian or budding authoritarian figure threatens human rights, when actually what we're trying to do is, it's actually a pretty modest project if you really think about it. You know, it's to build a social democratic state. It's about building a welfare state, about having the minimal amounts of support for the population so that people can thrive. You know, people often ask me, why did I return to Mexico? Well, on the one hand, to participate and to contribute in the improvement of my country. But the other thing is also, as a working class person myself, I find it easier to not just survive, but to thrive. You know, we have a public health system that is being strengthened. You know, we have public transportation that is affordable and extensive. We have public parks. We have social programs for youth. I feel safer on the streets of Mexico City than I did a few days ago when I was in Washington, D.C. You know, I've talked with friends who live in the United States, and they mentioned that sometimes it feels like U.S. society is coming apart at the seams. Like, there's just so much pressure on people to be able to survive that it really kind of has a negative effect on the enjoyment of life inside the United States. And admittedly, it was anecdotal, but I also lived many years in the United States and Canada, and I saw what that looks like. That's something I can't say about Mexico. Here, I feel so much more alive. You know, I can feel like I can actually thrive as a human being. Obviously, there's also a lot of poverty in Mexico, but that's what we're working to address so that we can have a more fuller experience and, yes, use the state to redistribute wealth.
Okay, so switching gears, let's talk about Morena. So can you give just a brief background about Morena, its impetus? It was a movement turned party, but how did it... How did Morena win, and then how has the government approached these types of social improvements? How has it expanded the welfare state?
You know, for a time there, the left, the electoral left, because we should be clear, there is an extra parliamentary left here in Mexico as well, but the electoral left was orphaned. There was a party called the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, that was born out of a breakaway from the Institutional Revolutionary Party, as a result of the fraud that happened in 1998. But the kind of the fissure started before 1988. And so the PRD for a time was the home of those who sought to participate in parliamentary politics. But then after 2012, the party sold out. It joined what was officially called El Pacto por Mexico, the Pact for Mexico, where it aligned itself with the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, and the National Action Party, the PAN. So it became very much co-opted and helped advance Peña Nieto's neoliberal agenda. And so the left had to find somewhere else to organize itself. And that is what gave birth to Morena, very much under the leadership of López Obrador. And very quickly after being founded as a party, it started winning elections, and obviously winning 2018 was huge, because it wasn't just winning the election for the presidency. He won with a landslide. He won with more than 20 points over his nearest rival, over 53 million votes, right? Like, that's a strong mandate, which also translated into a strong majority inside of the Congress. And so there is a very strong mandate to be able to carry out what López Obrador calls the fourth transformation of Mexico. And since then, it's actually continued to be very successful. Of 15 governorship races, it's won 12. It now controls the vast majority of the governorships in this country, expanding not just its power, but its territorial reach. That also informs a bit why we see this kind of coverage inside the United States. I've mentioned this previously in other interviews, but basically the opposition hasn't figured out a way to respond to this political moment. And so they try to hide inside of their conservative strongholds to try to continue to exert power, despite the fact that they don't count on the majority support anymore. They don't really win elections like they used to. And so they're finding themselves marginalized. And so they turn to these think tanks, they turn to imperialism, they turn to these forces where they feel like they can still exert power. And so Morena, has contradictions as well. It's a bit of a mess internally. Right now, everybody's focused on the succession. And I want to close on that with this question. It's a race to see who will be the next president. At the middle, we have Adán Augusto López. He's kind of the centrist. He represents a continuation of López Obrador's policies. We have on the right, Marcelo Ebrard, the foreign minister, always been a very loyal lieutenant to López Obrador, but very much represents more, a more right-wing position. And then there's the left. There's Claudia Sheinbaum, jefa de gobierno, or Mexico City governor, and she very much represents the left candidate in this. López Obrador says he doesn't have a favorite, but it's kind of clear that she's his favorite. And so far, she's leading the polls. So what's next is to figure out who will be the representative and what that means. Mexico's a very presidentialist system, right? Presidencialista, we say. Whoever is the candidate, whoever becomes the president, will command a lot of authority inside of the party and will actually help determine, will this process kind of keep going in the same direction? Will it turn to the right, or will it become radicalized and become deeper in terms of the transformation?
And then in terms of polling, just to give some background, what's the approval rating for AMLO right now?
It's sky high. It's extraordinary. Depending on which polling firm you ask, it's somewhere between 60 and 80% approval. And he's amongst the most popular presidents in the world. And so consistently polls very, very, very well. The truth is that despite the very real problems that continue to exist in this country, right? It's, he hasn't transformed everything. Like I said, there's a modest welfare state being constructed. I will say this, 70% of households count on at least one social program. There's been expansion of cash transfer programs. There's been building of new infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And so people see that this government's different, right? They understand that there is a commitment to the interests of the working class, of the campesinos, of the middle class, the one that didn't exist previously, right? There's a direct access to the president, who gives a daily press conference, which really helps kind of counter the narrative that's out there about that. And that's why he remains popular.
Well, you can't just give people money.
That's what they say, but it actually works out pretty well here.
I know, it was a common refrain, like during COVID, right? When there were so many people out of work, it's like, well, you can't just give people money. Really? Because maybe you can.
And you know what they spend it on? Food, medicine, right. Outings, yeah. With the family. That stuff stimulates the economy way more than a tax break for the super rich.
Yeah. And so lastly, I wanted to ask you, you're Mexican, but you can give some unique perspective into Mexican politics and the situation in Mexico, given your time having lived in Canada and the United States. So just what do you think it's important for the rest of North America to understand about Mexico? What should they keep in the back of their minds when they listen to the news?
I mentioned earlier in another response about how tragic it seemed that in a country so wealthy that there's so much inequality inside of the United States when I was there recently visiting. That's also true of Mexico. There's no need for there to be the kind of poverty and marginalization that exists here in Mexico or the United States. But speaking about the country, right? Mexico's a wealthy country, right? It has a diverse economy. It has lots of natural resources. But somehow none of that has ever really made it to us. To us, the working class. Instead, what we've seen is a deepening of neoliberal orthodoxy. What we've seen is a growing gap between the rich and the poor. We've seen transnational companies having a field day in the country. When the free trade agreement was first being proposed way back in the early 90s, there was this promise that Mexico was going to become a first world country if we signed this agreement. Well, it's been a number of years now, and that never happened. And so now we're pursuing a different strategy. Right, that Mexico is seeking to use the resources of this country in order to benefit the people of this country, right? That doesn't mean that it's going to become a hermit state closed off to the rest of the world. López Obrador just the other week actually stood up to defend the US dollar as the primary instrument for international trade. But the point is that we should be allowed to assert our sovereignty and choose our economic path, our social path, to decide that we want to do things a little bit differently and not have to face the wrath of imperialism, not have to face these demonizing articles. You know, working class Mexicans and working class North Americans have more in common than they don't, right? I know lots of people throughout North America love to visit Mexico on vacation and they have an amazing time. And they always come back saying, oh, I just met the most amazing people. We can be allies in this struggle. We have a common enemy, but we do need people in North America to resist the forces of US imperialism so that we can have that room to breathe and perhaps serve as a model of inspiration to show that things don't have to be the way that they are, that things can get better for us, the working class.
Awesome. Thank you so much, José Luis, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Old Mole Luisa Martinez interviewing José Luis Granal Ceja. Part one of that interview can be found on the Old Mole website in the program of June 26th. Our final segment on today's show has both Pacific Northwest and Latin American roots. Michael Leibowitz, professor at Simon Fraser in British Columbia, who died recently, was a scholar who made significant contributions to Marxist theory and an activist who lived his beliefs, notably in programs he created in Venezuela and policies he encouraged there. He had the ear of Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, who cited Michael in some of his presidential radio broadcasts. I mentioned earlier that racism is not simply incidental to capitalism, but is integral to it. For much of the time Karl Marx lived, most Marxists tended to theorize about workers as if we were interchangeable commodities. One of Michael's contributions was his recognition that dividing workers by race, gender, and other ways was integral to capital's control. Here, all too briefly, I remember Michael. On the Old Mole, we've done several memorials over the past couple of years for people of our political community who've passed away. We feel that recognizing them, reminding ourselves of their commitments and contributions, is a way of reinforcing bonds within the community, here in Oregon and beyond. Today I want to note the recent death of Michael Leibowitz, who lived in British Columbia and also in Venezuela, and was a listener to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Michael was a scholar who made significant contributions to Marxist theory and an activist who lived his beliefs, as I said before, in programs he created in Venezuela and the policies that he encouraged there. Hugo Chavez paid attention to him, that was the president of Venezuela, and even in some of his own, that is, Hugo Chavez, did regular radio broadcasts, and even some of his own presidential broadcasts, he mentioned Michael. Sometimes you can think of conversation topics when it's regrettably too late to have the conversation. I knew Michael mainly through his books and occasional emails back and forth. It's only after his death that I realized how our paths had crossed long ago. Coming out of graduate school, I accepted a position at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia in the PSA department, that is, political science, sociology, anthropology. It was that combination of those three, political science, sociology, anthropology, in one department that attracted me, along with the department's exceptional ties to the working class community in Vancouver. My invitation from that department, and then approval by the Faculty Senate, was unanimous, but then was vetoed by the university administration because of my own anti-war activism. This is back in the times, of course, of the Vietnam War. The administration put the PSA department in receivership, bringing in a geologist, if I remember correctly, to chair it, and some of the outstanding faculty who were there left Simon Fraser in protest. My appointment was only the pretext for the administration's disciplining and taming and ripping apart an excellent department they saw as problematic because of its ties to community and labor activism. What I've only now learned is that Michael Leibowitz was president of the faculty union at Simon Fraser at that time and was stalwart in trying to secure my appointment and in defending the PSA department. We could have been colleagues and good friends decades earlier. There was a persistent theme in Michael's work, the relationship between changing circumstances that then enabled people to change and the intentional efforts at self-change, self-realization, that can come as part of the struggle to then in turn change the circumstances. The dialectic, in other words, that's inherent in revolutionary practice. We make a difference in the world through our activism, and that activism in turn can develop new capabilities in us and an enhanced sense of our capability. Michael was a good writer. Rare for an economist, his writing was enjoyable, always linking the economics to politics and culture, and the need for change at each of those interconnected levels. As distinct from many Marxists, for whom capital reduces all workers to undifferentiated abstractions, seeing them only for their capacity to produce profits, Michael argued that capital needs to see workers as gendered, as racial, as differentiated groups to play off against each other in order to exercise control. In other words, that capitalism is a political and social as well as a narrowly economic system. He argued that the transition away from capitalism to socialism would have to use the leverage of state institutions, simultaneously transforming the state itself, democratizing and decentralizing it. This is an issue I want to address at a different time on The Old Mole, especially with regard to a recent book by Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin with Stephen Marr, The Socialist Challenge Today, that explores the experience of Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn in Great Britain, and the movement around Bernie Sanders, all with reference to how they related to and attempted to use the institutions of the state. For Leibowitz, the state in transition would be very different from the top-down structures we've seen in many societies that have called themselves socialist. It would encourage neighborhood and worker councils, allocate its resources, and do its work through these councils, and eventually dissolve and be taken over by them. He drew on his experience living in Venezuela to write about these possibilities more broadly. Here on The Old Mole, you've heard them explored also through interviews Luisa Martinez has done with Venezuelan activists. Michael's starting point was the limitation on human development and the distortion of human possibilities under capitalism, where he found hope, where he saw revolutionary potential, was not only in workers' place in capitalist production and its potential leverage, but in our persisting desire to satisfy our human needs and our ability to transform ourselves through struggle. Michael made significant contributions and lived the implications of his theory. As we say in Latin America, Michael Leibowitz, presente. And that's our program for today. I'd like to thank Old Mole's Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, Matt Witt, Luisa Martinez, and guest Jose Luis Granados Ceja. And always, I want to express the Old Mole appreciation for the dedicated staff at KBOO. Until next Monday morning, this is Norm Diamond, hoping you stay safe and stay active.
Caleb Nguyen, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starve to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 9-